Inger, det går kraftedme ikke at svømme mod strømmen i et revlehul. Der skal man flyde ud med strømmen.
Og svømme langs kysten og i.
Ja.
Undgå drama på badeturen. Hold øje med revlehuller. Er du ved det, de rødhvide tårne, kan du altid spørge en af os livredder for Trygfonden Kystlivredning.
Det er tid til at gå bag om facaden. Yeah! Velkommen til Behind the Vinyl med Darren Edwards og Niklas Müller. My Rock.
All right, another episode of Behind the Vinyl. Me, Niklas, joined by the Australian guy, Darren.
Of course.
And the one and only, Mr. Dave Ellefson. How are you doing?
How you doing? What's going on? In Sweden, I actually have a little Swedish in me, believe it or not. I've done the family tree long before Ancestry.com and all that, and on my dad's side, Norwegian, German, on my mother's side, English and Swedish.
Oh, there you go.
It's good to be home.
Yeah, absolutely. Home of the Vikings.
Yeah, right?
Hell yeah. Jesus.
Nice to have you in town.
Yes. Yeah, thank you.
A little bit of a bucket list kind of guest. You know, we've had a lot of guests on here, and you're definitely up there with one of our bucket list names.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
Yeah. Good to have you here, and of course, We picked Rust in Peace.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, coming up to 30 years.
Seems to get picked a lot. It's it's one of the fan favorites. And you're right, it is. It's 30 years.
Yeah.
There will be some stuff coming up around that, just to tip a hat a little bit about it, as you would expect.
Yes.
I can't go into the details, but, you know, the album came out, I believe, in September, I think, right?
24th.
Yes. That sounds right. So, you know, if you're in the local record shop, keep your eyes open later in the year.
How do you feel this album, 30 years? Like, what does that make you feel?
Feel young?
You know, it's so funny. I mean, I don't think I've aged a bit. I mean, you know, look in the mirror and other people may say the other opposite, but you know, Rust in Peace was a big record for me, not so much musically, because it's just kind of a continuation of what we were already doing, writing very complex, difficult, intricate music. I mean, really prog rock for all intents and purposes. I guess the only thing that differentiates prog from thrash is prog is in 7/4 and thrash is in 4/4.
Right, yeah.
You know, and we've got a little bit of the Led Zeppelin thing where, you know, Dave would write a riff and we just put the drums in 4/4 and eventually it circles around and lands back on the one, you know, which is... I think having Nick Menza come in on this record was funny because Nick would always hear Dave's riff starting on the upbeat. And so he would play it backwards. He'd play in the upbeat. And
all right.
Like,
okay.
No. You're starting on. Here's the one. And Nick would be like, "No, I swear it's not." You know. And so lots of times, Nick's really for the next decade, starting with Rust in Peace, but the next decade, some of Nick's most brilliant moments were his mistakes. And he would do something, and Dave would go, "Wait. What did you just do?" He goes, "I don't know. It was a mistake." He goes, "Wait. We're, you know, left side." We learned to start recording rehearsals and writing sessions.
Right, yeah.
Right.
You know, his run tape, and he's like, "Back that up. Let's hear what he did." And Nick would just laugh. He goes, "It was a mistake. I can't even play it again." You know, so there's, you know, the creativity. You know, it was definitely a season of restructuring, redirecting the future of Megadeth, and to me, that's what that album. You know, for the fan, obviously to the listener, it should be about the music. But me internally, these records are, it's like looking at a photo album. And, you know, you go, "Oh, yeah, there we were with Uncle Jim out fishing, you know, and, oh, yeah, Uncle Sally's or Uncle whatever, Joe's drunk by the fire and, you know, whatever." You kind of remember. And to me, that's what these albums are, is they're just they're like photo albums. They're
right.
Sonic photo albums, and they're just snapshots of my life, our life together as a band.
Yeah.
And so that's what I get when we go down memory lane like this with these interviews like this, is I think about who, what, when, and where, and sometimes, you know, the names are changed to protect the guilty, you know.
Race, no more disgrace, no foolish naive stand.
But I want to ask, I want to start off with, you had Mike Klink.
Mm-hmm.
And before that, he'd done Appetite for Destruction.
Right.
He'd done Sea Hags,
mm-hmm.
who turned into nothing, really. Yep. Great band, though. And he'd done Triumph before that, and he'd worked on And Justice for All with Metallica. Started off working on that.
But you know what we were most impressed with is that he had worked on Strangers in the Night by UFO.
UFO, of course.
That was the record that got me and Dave and Marty excited. Right. Now, of course, the Guns record was huge.
Yeah. Wasn't that the record that got him Guns as well?
You know, I don't know. I mean, Mike and I are good friends, and you know, he's got a book in him. I mean, man. I mean, you know, so apparently, from what he told me, he had worked under Ron Nevison, the producer.
Right.
And that's how he got, you know, was working on the UFO stuff. And, of course, we were like, come on, tell us some Michael Schenker stories. You know, that's all we wanted to know. We wanted to know, you not so much dirt, but just, you know, I think about that time we started to realize, wait a minute, all these bands were all the same, right? There's the same kind of cast of characters. And it wasn't so much about digging dirt and that kind of stuff, but it's you know, sometimes when your heroes are made human, especially when you're in cutting a record and we're on Capitol Records and we're working with real producers and, you know, and all of a sudden it's kind of like, wow, we're one of them, you know, and that was a cool moment, I think, for all of us in Megadeth to go like, wow, we're here now. I didn't feel like we had arrived yet, you know,
right.
Because really, I think probably Rust in Peace is the record that turned the corner. You know, new decade,
yep.
New record, new producer, new management with Ron Lafitte managing us, really pulling things together. Because Dave and I were a mess. We were drug addicts. We were on drugs. You know, in the early days, it was just using a lot of drugs, having a lot of fun. And
right.
then it crossed the line into being strung out and being, you know, addicts. And that was really what late 88 through 89 was about. And, you know, I got clean March 1st, 1990, and I've stayed clean ever since, thank God. And, you know, that was really the big turning thing.
Right.
'Cause that changes everything.
Yeah.
It changes how you treat people, how you view people, what your day-to-day routine is. I mean, I think I was in cutting tracks, my bass tracks on that record, like 3 weeks sober, maybe
right.
a month sober.
Wow.
I was going to say, so you must have written this record and recorded
high.
Some of it.
Super high. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, and we weren't even high. That was just our lifestyle.
Yep.
You know, that's the difference when you go from being a drug user to being a drug addict.
Right.
When you're an addict, you know, just getting drugs is to just get well, to get normal.
Yeah.
So you can go be productive. You
right.
know? And that record, I mean, it was methadone clinics. It was rehab. It was... Yeah. Hiring managers firing us and hiring new managers and, you know, guitar techs quit. I mean, even the guitar techs quit. They're like, we can't even take these guys, you know, like,
yeah, yeah.
And fortunately when Nick came in, and this was 1989, you know, when Nick came in, he was patient enough with, you know, me and Dave. Ron Lafitte had wanted to manage the band for a number of years, and he had been on the road as a tour manager for Armored Saint on the Metallica Wasp Armored Saint tour. You
right,
know, kind of
right,
guy.
Right, right, yeah.
His, you know, his learned some chops there, and then he became a manager. Of course, now he manages Pharrell Williams, you know, One Republic. I mean, he's top tier.
Right.
He's one of the biggest managers in the world now, you know. But has remained a dear friend, and it's interesting when we had this lifestyle and connection together with that. And Ron saved my life, man. He helped me get clean. You know, he looked me in the eye one day in the kitchen at the apartment me and Dave had, and I came home from the drug dealer, and I was in tears, and I just said, I can't take it. And he said, look, if you want help, I'll drop everything to help you, but
right.
you really got to want it. And I did. I said, I do. And he did, and he did everything he could in his power, and again, took a few months, but I got clean, and here I am, you know, so I mean, I owe my life to Ron. Welcome to our fortress tower. Take some time to show you around. Impossible to break these walls. For you see, the steel is much too strong. Computer banks to rule the world. Western men's to set the stars. Possibly I've seen too much. And you're 18, I know too much. We'll be right back.
Behind the Vinyl med Darren Edwards og Niklas Müller. My Rock.
So this is pretty intricate kind of music too on this. So how did you find playing in that state this kind of music?
You know, that's a good question, because I think, you know what, when Gar and Chris were in the band, and it's funny because my team Ellison, Tom Hazard, is working on a memoir with Chris Pullen, because boy, buy that book when it comes out, because that's got stories, and he doesn't have to pull any punches because he's not in the band. And,
yeah, right.
And it's a great book, and Chris right. is as well as has been sober many years, and so he's an adult, and he can own his side of the street.
Yeah.
It's great. But when Gar and Chris were in the band, that was, you know, they were jazz musicians, and that
right.
was kind of this, you know, if you want to be like the greats, you got to be high, you got to take heroin, you got to do what the greats did. Of course, we never thought, well, all the greats died.
Yeah.
You know, you forget that part. But that was when the road down into the, you know, cocaine and the heroin use started. Mm. You know, so this is, you know, two records later.
Right.
You know, that Dave and I are now, again, down into this lifestyle. And And, you know, when so while we were writing, we, you know, again, it was the last thing you wanted to do. I remember Keith Richards' quote. He said, he goes, "I never get sick until I run out of drugs." And that was some quote he had many years ago, you know. And I, you know, that was it. It's like as long as there is a supply going, you know, being loaded, being strung out was normal and you could play fine. And, and I, so I got the whole jazz musician mentality. I understood it. But then, you know, comes this turn in this corner into sobriety to record the record. So writing the record, you know, I mean, look, we go to rehearsal 5 days a week. That's what we did at odd hours of the day because it's all predicated around when you scored the drugs. Right. You know what I mean? Yeah. And you're dealing with drug dealer hours and that kind of stuff and in and out of rehab. And, you know, so the writing of that record, you know, it was not a record, except for The Poison Was the Cure, which is actually a title that Chris Poland wrote down on a pad of paper on the P-Cells tour.
Oh, right.
He wrote it down.
All right.
Yep. Yeah, it was called The Poison Was the Cure. It was about heroin, you know, that the poison becomes the cure when you're strung out. And so we wrote this record, you know, through this whole season. And then, of course, we recorded it. It's completely clean. I mean, totally sober. But I mean, the writing started in on the So Far So Good So What tour. Mm. Holy Wars was pretty much written on that tour. And we came off the road. We went in the studio. I seem to remember it was written on the road. Maybe we wrote it right after we came home. And there was we played Castle Donington, Monsters Rock.
Yes.
I went home, went to rehab first. And then that started that. And the thing that sucks about rehab is it just ruins your drug using because now you know better. You know what I mean? Like, as if you didn't before. And of course we do. But now all of a sudden it's sort of like the mirror of truth is in front of you, you know? And so now we're in trying to record and now the drug use was now called out, so to speak. It was kind of called out on the rug, you know? And it was sort of like, hey, this is an issue. Well, we'll deal with that later. So we write Holy Wars. We write Tornado of Souls, even though we didn't have the title yet. Mm-hmm. I think there's another title, Child Saint, which is a song title Dave had for many years, was kind of kicking this idea around. And there's a scratch vocal of that, actually, on a demo. Because we did a demo where we put down Holy Wars, Polaris. Mm-hmm. That wasn't even Rust in Peace Polaris, because the Rust in Peace thing came right before we recorded the record. And then Tornado of Souls, which, again, musically, those three were complete. I mean, top to bottom. And Holy Wars was complete with lyrics, almost exactly the arrangement, except for the little flamenco guitar part Marty added when we got him in the band. Otherwise, that song was pretty much exactly written like that and made it to the final cut like that.
let's touch on that a little bit lyrically, right? It comes from, you know, the old tale of it coming out of Belfast, coming of
something. Yeah, Holy Wars, right.
Yeah, Holy Wars, something Dave said. And something you pulled him up on, they had to rush you guys out of there or sneak you.
Well, we didn't know. I mean, you know, we're, again, drinking a bunch of Guinness and, you know, a bunch of Irish beers, you know, and just rolling how we did on So Far, So Good, So What back in those days. And you know, usually we'd go on tour and we'd be detoxing, which sucks to be on tour playing speed metal, detoxing off heroin, off of an opiate.
You get the gear in.
So then you drink a lot to just sort of take away the pain and sort of blot out the, you know, the consciousness of your state of being, you know what I mean? And that's what happened that night. And, and they were selling our merchandising. And, again, it was a very, you know, internal situation with you know, where does the money go? Well, not to the band, you know. And Dave's not one to let stuff just slide, you know what I mean? So but not knowing the politics and what that was, I mean, look, it's YouTube, you know, Sunday Bloody Sunday, for lack of a better description. That's what it is, you know. And we're escorted out on in a bus, like, you know, get out of here, to the hotel we go. And you know, then it's one of those things when you wreak havoc in a town, it's like, are we going to be able to cross the border and get out of here? You know, because Belfast, you know, the Northern Ireland was essentially a separate state from Southern Ireland, as you both well know. But, you know, we being Americans, I mean, we don't have these problems in America.
No.
I mean, you know, we've got many states which are just like the countries of Europe, but all the states play nice together. Yeah. You know, that's the whole point of it.
Yeah. And
so these kind of conflicts were very... You know, you realize, whoa, this is a whole different playground here, you know. And but I think lyrically that the lyric of Holy War stands today. I mean, even as we sing it, you know, last night singing it on stage, I'm just like, man, this applies as much today, 30 years later.
It does.
It does.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
Det her er Behind the Vinyl på My Rock.
Let's go back a little bit. You mentioned, let's talk about Nick Menza first.
Mm-hmm.
He was actually the drum tech, right?
He was, and I mean, he was a drummer. His father, it's funny, his father, Don Menza, esteemed first chair tenor saxophonist for Buddy Rich, Louis Belson, a noted woodwind player in the jazz world and the bebop genre in particular. So it's funny that Nick, and he even said it in his book, you know, how do you rebel against your dad who, you know, bebop was the rock and roll. That was the thrash metal of jazz. That was like rebellious even against jazz, you know. So like Nick even said in his book, he goes, if my dad played rock and roll, I would have played jazz. But because he played jazz, I played rock and roll. Like, you know what I mean? Like, how do you rebel against your musician dad?
Yeah.
You know, so, you know, Nick just had a rebellious spirit in him. And he was very creative. And he was a great rock star. Just his boldness and just his you know, just he attacked the drums. You know, he attacked life. He didn't just subtly walk in. He just really went for it. And I think that was something Megadeth needed. I love Chuck Beeler's playing. I just played with him a few months ago when I went through Detroit. I got him back out. We played some of the So Far So Good So What songs, and man, those songs only feel that good when he's playing them. I mean, it's incredible. I just looked at him and I went, man, I love playing with you. It's as if it's 1987, 88, and we're recording So Far So Good So What. He's just got this behind the beat, backbeat style.
Yeah.
Nick Menza, completely the opposite. Pushing the beat, pushing the band, really driving from behind, you know?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as much as, you know, Chuck had a big part of those early songs on Rust in Peace, those first three. I mean, he demoed those and he was essentially in the band. But then as we started to, we needed a guitar player because things were done with Jeff Young. It wasn't going to go forward anymore. So we reached out to Jeff Waters, but Annihilator was blowing up. And Jeff was a very different person. And we joke about it now because now I'm good friends with him. In fact, I just helped officiate his wedding.
Play.
saw a picture of you recently. I think you were driving and Jeff and his wife were in
the taxi. Exactly. Yeah. Actually, I think we're in an Uber. Yeah, but I was doing the selfie. Yeah. And so, like, we're best friends. We talk about the what if I was in Megadeth, you know? And it wasn't meant to be at that time. And then the next person we reached out to, I was dating this girl down in Fort Worth, Texas, Dallas, basically. And she introduced me to the Pantera guys when we were down. And we went out one night and went drinking. This was 88, so I was still partying. And, you know, he wasn't Dimebag, he was Diamond Darrell back then, right? Yeah. And he was a real guitar star. He was in all the little kind of fanzine magazines and stuff. And we went out drinking, and he told me, he goes, at the end of the night, he goes, Dad, Peace Sales changed my life, you know? That was like a sober moment in the midst of all of our drinking. Yeah. He just looked at me and he goes, Peace Sales, that record changed my life. And I was just like, wow, no kidding. And the next night they played and invited me up. I jammed Peace Sales with them. And those guys could drink a ton and play really good. I mean, it was shocking how hammered they would be, yet just kicking ass like Van Halen. I mean, it's just amazing. And so they, you know, fast forward a few months, and I tell Dave about, you know, about Daryl. And so Dave called him up. And he said, hey, I'm honored, but with me comes my brother. And at the time, you know, we didn't need a drummer. We had Chuck Beeler.
Yeah.
So it wasn't meant to be, obviously.
Did you think about recalling him when Chuck...
Because, you know, the thing is, you know, as life moved, then the next thing that happened is Chuck was, you know, we were all very loaded, you know, and Chuck just sort of disappeared into the background, you know, and so we had to move forward, and that's when we called Nick and said, you know, because that was one of the reasons Nick was out drum teching on the So Far So Good So What tour. It was kind of as an understudy, just in case anything happened.
Right. Gotcha.
I've actually never heard that before.
No.
Yeah,
exactly. And so Nick was ready to go. And so Dave said, look, go get in the studio with him. Let's get it going, you know. So I broke in a lot of Megadeth members in, guitar players and otherwise. Yeah, I mean, I even the guitar players, I can usually get them because I can play rhythm guitar really well. And I know, you know, certainly in those days, that Megadeth stuff, I knew all the rhythm parts. So I could, even Marty, I mean, I could get him to about 80%. And then I'd have to hand him over to Dave to polish him up, you know, and finish it off, you know. But you know, it's part of my role in the band, you know. But I took Nick in and to audition. And he rushed and pushed the tempo. So I'm like, bro, you got to pull it back, you know. But he was excited, but he had an energy, and you know what? Me and Dave needed that. The band needed that. The band needed someone really just pushing, you know. And he did it on the drums. He did it in life. He would often push Dave too far, like, you know, like the first night he's drum teching for us. Dave, we were playing a little warm up show on the So Far So Good So What tour, and like Riverside, California, outside of LA or something. And Dave was late coming down because of the traffic on the freeway, so he didn't make a sound check. So Nick goes right up to the mic and starts singing Peace Sells. I'm like, dude, you got some fucking balls, man, stepping into the batter's box right there. Yeah. Like, that's kind of sacred ground. Like no, especially a new guy, you know, like, you don't do that. You know what I mean? And that right there, I mean, from day one with Nick, I'm like, this guy, you know what I mean? So it's, but you know, that chemistry in the band, I mean, I think ultimately it landed him out of the band 10 years later. Yeah. I mean, I think, you know, there just came up a point where it's like, you know, part of life is knowing when to apply pressure.
Yes.
And then the other part, you know, hit the gas, hit the brake.
Yep.
You know, you can't hit the brake, the gas the whole time, or you're just going to run into stuff, you know? Yep. But, you know, so, you know, he came into the band, I guess, I don't know, April, May of 89. And then that began, you know, him in the band, and then the rehearsals, we wrote the rest of the record with him there, you know. So it's probably half of it was done up till then, and then we finished the other half of it with Nick. We'll be right back.
And then you get Marty,
then you get
the
Marty.
Poser.
Well, and it's funny. Before that, even, we were a three-piece. So we had this all done.
Right.
Ron Lafitte comes in to manage us. We start getting sobered up. And in December of 89, we went into a EMI Music Publishing, who's our publisher at the time, had a songwriting studio in the office right there on Sunset Boulevard, right across the street from the infamous Tower Records.
Oh, right. Right,
yep. And that was where Lafitte's management office was. He worked for a company there called Lippman & Kahane. And so we went in to demo basically the Rust in Peace, everything except Dawn Patrol, because that we didn't have that. I didn't have that little riff yet.
Yeah.
And to just kind of get a feel of the two guitar, we thought, well, shit, well, I guess we're going to do it like So Far So Good as What. It'll be the three of us.
Yeah. Yeah.
And we'll get, you know, whoever the new Jeff Young guy is,
right.
We'll get him to come in, and I guess we'll pick it up from there, you know?
Yeah.
So we hired Chris Poland to come in and play
right.
on those tracks, just to give it a bit of a different sound and and may have even been kind of, Marty may have, I think we, so basically we record that, it's December, flip the calendar, now it's January, 1990. Mm. And so I think it was, it was when we were doing those demos, we went downstairs to Lafitte's office, and there were these two records sitting there, Cacophony and Marty Friedman's Dragon's Kiss. And we're like, who's this guy? And he goes, and Ron told us, he goes, dude, guys, I've been telling you, this guy wants an audition. He's been calling, he's saying his record's over, and because he was on Mike Varney's Shrapnel record, right?
Yes.
And so we're like, well, we know who he is. He was in Hawaii, remember his band Hawaii. And me and Dave were like, we got nothing to lose. During 89, we'd already auditioned like 10 people with no success.
Right.
In fact, that was right when Nick got in the band, we started auditioning some guys.
Yeah.
And basically, we'd bring him in, and we could tell when a guy walks in the room is like, that ain't the guy.
Right. Yeah.
Like, you can just tell, like, how he dresses, how he looks, his demeanor.
But you know, those guys, were they known guys? Or
no,
just like
mostly unknown guys. Yeah. Mostly unknown guys, And it just wasn't the right thing. And so we basically, they'd come in, we'd play a song or two. And then we'd tell Nick, you got to usher him out and tell him, like, they're not going to get the job, Let the new guy do that. So we'd been through that. That's why we went in the studio, and then we had Chris play on some solos, lay some stuff down. So we turned the corner into 1990, and we're like, all right, look, let's get this Marty guy down here and see what he's got. And we were kind of like a little laissé about it because it's like, none of these other guys have worked, But I tell you, he hired a guitar tech who loaded all the stuff in. He showed up. He looked like he was in the Ramones, had his Ramones shirt on, his jeans with his holes in them. And he had a look. It was like, this guy looks like at least a professional rock and roll guitar player, And, he plugged in, he had all of his Carvin gears, Carvin amps and guitars. And he, I think we played Wake Up Dead and I forgot. A couple tunes that we played, and you're like, I stood next to him when we played, and he looked cool. He at least had a vibe. He had an energy, and it was like, we sound pretty good with him. And again, this music is very intricate, all this Megadeth stuff, and it's impossible to get all of it without sitting down in the room and going over the details. And he was probably 75% there, and it was like, and Martin Dave just went outside and he came back in and he said, okay, you're the guy. Let's go. Let's get to work. And I mean, it was kind of like made the decision, and that was it. And then right after that, the opportunity for Mike Klink. This is probably January of 1990, and like literally a week or two later, Lafitte, one of the Lippman and Kahane, there are two brothers. Michael Lippman was the older brother, and then the younger brother Terry Lippman was and still is a manager of record producers.
Right.
So he managed Richie Zito and, I think Ron Nevison and a bunch of guys.
All right.
So and also managed Mike Klink. Well, what we didn't. So suddenly Mike Klink, hey, Mike's available.
Klassiker under loop. Klassiker under loop. Behind the vinyl på My Rock.
Well, what we didn't know was that Mike was kind of just on a break with Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
But once Axl called, he had to leave.
Right.
Like, he had to get back to work on that record. Well, we didn't know that. So we're like, look, Mike comes down. He hears what we're doing. At this point, the record's done. It's written. I mean, it's all he really had to do is record it, and he's a fantastic engineer. And so, when we went in the studio to start recording, me and Nick, Went in the room. Dave, we laid down a sort of a scratch pass, wrote the click tracks. We actually had click tracks. And then as we recorded the songs, and every one of these songs on Rust in Peace, they almost all have at least a couple different tempos in them. Mm, you know, right. Five Magics, we called that the master of five tempos, because it's literally got like five tempos in the thing. And so basically we had the scratch guitar laid down to a click track, and then me and Nick went in, and I basically, you know, was the band leader for Nick. I played along with him with bass, and we cut the drum tracks. And we took three takes of every section. And then Mike went in with the razor blade on 2-inch tape and cut it together, which is an art.
Yeah.
I mean, this day, you know, on Pro Tools, if you mess it up, yeah. Undo, yeah. You know. Yeah. But, you know, that those days, I mean, cutting tape, and it took him like a week. We took about a week to cut drum tracks, a week to cut it together.
And expensive.
It's expensive, yeah. Right. In a big room, Rumbo Recorders, which is owned by the Captain and Tennille. Remember, I don't know if you remember, as a kid, remember the Captain and Tennille? They were remember Muscat Love and... They were a huge pop star. Yeah, they had a TV show in America when I was a kid. I mean, it was like Sonny
and Cher.
Well,
that's it.
Cheer.
I think they were huge in America.
Huge,
I think no one knew about them in Europe or outside
America. They were
America.
The ABBA of America.
Exactly, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. In the 70s, you know. So Daryl Dragon, the husband and the keyboard player, you know, he owned that studio. And we were in that big room for like a month, locked out, you know. And then a week of laying it down, a week of cutting drums, a week of chopping tape, a week of playing bass. Then I came in and played bass on it. And the bass parts were very complex. I mean, just again, because there's no Pro Tools, you can't just sort of fix it later. And, you know, these days, if you put something down, you know, the guy running Pro Tools is like a fifth Beatle.
Yeah.
You know, and they're good and they're so quick. And they're like, look, let me just fix it over here. And they can sort of nudge and fit and put things together, you know. But back then, I mean, you know, when you hit the red button, it's destructive record and you can't get the take back, you know.
Right.
There's no do-over. So when you're, you know. So, but Mike was an incredible engineer. And he was, that was the level of production we needed with it, you know. Right. And then Dave came in, and the first song he played guitar on was Holy Wars. The first song he sang on was Holy Wars. And, you know, so it's, and then on it went from there, you know, and putting it together. The first solo Marty played was Tornado of Souls.
All right. Okay.
So some of these, you know, a couple, it's kind of interesting, those two songs, because they're probably a couple of the standouts.
Yeah.
And while we were, while we were putting the bass down, Mike Klink would always look at me and goes, "So do you guys have any more songs?" I said, "Mike, this is it. We got, whatever, 7, 8 songs." In fact, a couple of them had split titles.
Right, okay.
Holy Wars, Punishment Due.
Yeah.
Rest in Peace, Polaris, you know. And and at this point, Dave had seen a bumper sticker that said, "May all your warheads rest in peace."
Right,
and
yeah.
That's where that we added Rest in Peace / Polaris. So I said, "Well, look, I got this bass part." And I laid it down. Nick played drums, which was Non-Patrol. And Nick laid down another thing that he had called My Creation, which is on, so I think, Worcester, on one of the B-sides of the records now. And Dave liked Dawn Patrol. He liked it. He went in and he cut a vocal on it. And that's how that became the ballad of Rust in Peace.
Right, yeah.
So that was just added while we were in the studio. So
cool.
Kind of lined out the record. Time.
But that also, I'm thinking, like, tape compared to Pro Tools must be, I can just run.
Yeah, okay.
You can. Yeah.
Yeah, tape, yeah, back.
That, I mean, since it was so expensive, you said, like, you had one take, you couldn't undo it, like, with Pro Tools. Didn't that, like, put, that has to put another type of pressure on you as a player compared to today where you can just fix it right away. Yeah. And
those big rooms, you know, they were $1,200, $1,500 a day.
Wow.
Times seven, times 4 weeks.
Right.
You know, then we moved over into the smaller room, which is, but you know, probably a less expensive room.
Right.
But still, we got engineers, we've got assistants.
Yeah.
There's the producer, you know, Mike's got a certain fee he's getting.
Exactly, exactly.
So, yeah, it's... you know, and we were younger musicians back then, you know, learning to kind of groove. And, you know, you know, I was 25, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, I forget how young me and Dave were when we were cutting this stuff, you know what I mean?
That is really young.
Yeah.
You know?
It's very young.
You're also a well and truly, established band, leading the pack. You know, there was basically two pack leaders then.
Yeah.
You and Metallica.
And Metallica, for sure. Yeah.
And 25 years old and releasing...
Right.
Questionably your best record, you know. My entry point was Peace Sells. You know, I still hold that as really
high.
Right. You know.
And that was very similar. I mean, a whole other set of circumstances around that. But, again, not a lot of money.
Yeah.
You know, we went from $8,000 for Killing Is My Business, and we got a big whopping $25,000 advance to do Peace Sells, which was a lot of money back then. But, again, we also had to try to live on that because we were broke, you know.
Yeah.
So, again, trying to, you know, make that record on that kind of money. But, you know, it's interesting when... you're in a room writing a record. And we're working on some of that even on the new record now because there's a spirit. I mean, the band now plays so good.
I mean,
with Dirk and Kiko. I mean, just great.
Unbelievable.
Unbelievable. Yeah. And that, even when we're in Nashville, it's, you know, there have been times when, you know, Dave will be working on stuff and he'll just leave the room and go back over to his house. And, you know, and then our engineer and producer, you know, Chris Rakestar, will be like, you know, you guys plug in, jam. Like, let's jam. And, I mean, we'll throw some riffs at each other. And it's just amazing how good we play.
Yeah,
cool.
You know, that it's so anyway, you know, I don't know yet the outcome of the new record. But there's a feeling about it that feels like it was back in probably the Rust in Peace days. Because I think Rust in Peace, again, wasn't just about the music. It was about, now there's four guys, we look the same.
Yep.
We listen to the same music.
Yep.
We're of a similar age. And I think that was the thing with the first two records with Gar and Chris. They were older musicians.
Right.
They'd had, their passion was really, they had a band called the New Yorkers, which is this heavy Mahavishnu kind of fusion type of stuff. They just missed the window for whatever reason, you know.
Yeah.
They zigged and the rest of the world zagged. You know, they're playing jazz and suddenly Hollywood wanted Motley Crue.
Right,
you know,
right.
And Wasp and Rat and all that. And that's what happened. And they didn't get in the circle in time. And, you know, so kind of disgruntled, guarded a day job working at BC Rich. You know, as cool as that is, it's, you know, when you're a musician, you'd still rather be playing.
Yep,
you know,
sure.
So now those guys get into Megadeth, but they're older. You know, now listening to me and Dave, and Dave's the boss, and he's younger than them, and, you know, not really one to negotiate too much, but it's kind of like, this is what we're doing, this is why we're doing it.
Yeah.
I was in Metallica, I know what I'm doing here, you know, like we're not screwing around, you know. And it was hard for them to take direction from Dave and from someone younger than them. And I get it, you know.
Oh, sure.
I get it.
Sure.
And in a different genre.
Yep.
You know, an unexplored new territory, you know. So it's easy to join Megadeth now because you kind of know what it is. Like, the blueprint has been laid out. But when you're writing the blueprint, that was a whole different story, you know, back in those. And Rust in Peace, I think, was still part of that blueprint for sure.
Yep. Yeah.
Rising in perpetual writing the primal jewels and the sanity they lose. Awakened in the morning to more air pollution warnings. Do we sleep on off to work while our nervous systems jerk? History and
I read our epitaph. We end our life as moles in the dark of the dawn patrol.
Behind the Vinyl. My Rock.
As a bass player, you're really instrumental in that scene as well. Can you feel that now? Do you get a lot of people coming up to you now and also name dropping Rust in Peace? Because sure, it's a very bass heavy record.
Yeah, but, for sure, yeah. For sure. No, absolutely. In fact, people ask me, hey, what new bass players you listen to? And I got it. You know, Tobias, I guess is how you. It's he's. Probably one of my favorite bass players.
Right.
I mean, he's just phenomenal. I love the bass riffs and the stuff that he plays on the Ghost records. And
All right.
I don't know if he plays it in the Final, but I know he certainly writes that stuff.
Right, yeah.
And it's great. I mean, that's great bass playing. That's like the kind of writing on the level of Glenn Hughes and, you know, this very aggressive type of playing that then you're going to lay a vocal on top of, a very melodic, because let's face it, you know, you might listen to a bass riff for a few bars, but then you're going to start listening to the singer again, what I mean? Yep. So, there really aren't, I wish there was. I wish there was someone that really caught me. I mean, obviously, you know, Justin from Tool is certainly one of the more recent, but again, that's even 20 years ago, you know? I think probably Tobias is one of the more outstanding bass players, and he's not known as a bass player because he's a singer of his band, knowing a little more that, from what he's disclosed in interviews about being, writes a lot of stuff on bass, it's like, that's good bass playing, man, to me, you know? That's bass playing that works well in songs.
Right, yeah.
Because, it's one thing to go to the NAMM show and hear some guy showing out his chops, but it's like I learned before we even recorded Killing Is My Business, it's like, okay, can you just play some eighth notes? Because that's what we need here.
Yeah.
Right, and if you can't, we're going to call someone else who can.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was a real wake up. And I never got it put to me that harshly. But the message was, look, you really need to be able to just lock in with a click here. You know what I mean? Yeah. And that was a really, and which I could do fine, but suddenly playing this very complex Megadeth stuff, do I use fingers, do I use a pick? And that's how I ended up being a pick player, because it was just easier to play Dave's riffs with a pick than it was to play them with the fingers. The fingers just didn't work. It works great for Steve Harris. It works great for Geddy Lee.
Yeah.
It just did not work. And even with Cliff Burton. Yep. And I don't know how sometimes, because, knowing the, again, very similar rhythm guitar playing, the James and Dave, which is why I think even on Mechanics, which is our obviously our version of that song, the original version that Dave brought into Metallica, I play Ron McGovney's bass line.
Oh, right.
And he was a pick player.
Right.
You know what I mean? So when I, because the first Metallica I heard was not the Cliff Burton stuff. It was No Life Till Leather.
Yeah.
Of course.
Because I met Dave in June of 83, and that was, two, 3 months before Kill 'Em All came out. And so when I was listening to No Life Till Leather, I really liked McGovney's bass playing. I thought it was very cool. It was perfectly fitted for the songs.
Yeah.
He played with the picks. You could hear it well.
Yeah.
And it was just a good, supportive bass playing. Mm. Next time we talk, we'll get into that. What happened actually when we recorded and toured it. We just did the writing and leading up to it. Yeah. It was like a year and a half just to get to pressing the red button and recording the damn thing.
So stay tuned. There will be a part two of this one.
Yes.
Excellent, Dave. Thanks for your time.
Welcome. Thanks.
See you soon.
Saving waves is out there.
man har vendt pladen, og sidste nummer er spillet, så er Behind the Vinyl slut. Tough luck. Darren og Niklas er tilbage næste søndag kl. 16 med endnu et klassisk album. Og indtil da kan du fange denne og alle de forrige episoder som podcast på radioplay.dk/myrock. Adios.